Not too long ago, I heard someone say that they make six mistakes a day. And I thought to myself immediately of what the Red Queen so famously told Alice in Wonderland, that she believes six impossible things before breakfast. And I combined the two in my mind and decided that there are some mornings where I make six mistakes before breakfast. And I was thinking about that because, just like Moody Cow, I have so many dreams for how my morning will be. I imagine waking early for meditation, perhaps journaling for a little while before I have a cup of coffee on my own, and then my clean dressed children come out of their room. They make themselves a healthy breakfast. Maybe they pack their own healthy lunches as well before calmly walking out the door to start their days. I can tell by your laughter that you perceive a gap between the morning I'm describing and the morning that I have so often. How did you know? In any case, I have three young children right now in the house, and our mornings are often a little more chaotic than what I just described. Anyway, some mornings not too long ago, I decided to try out this new phrase about the mistakes with my son, and I think there had been some kind of minor calamity involving the wrong thing being packed in the lunch or the wrong plate color being presented to my youngest. And I turned to him and I said, "Well, you know, mommy makes six mistakes a day." And he said, "What were the other five?" And there's just so much about parenting that is caught up for me in that moment, but at least it made me laugh, right? I thought that was maybe one, but he was ready to go with me all the way to six. And I have to laugh at myself because I feel like I've really spent a lot of my life trying to eliminate mistakes, trying to get rid of normal sources of human error with systems and lists, with practice and planning. And this would not be inherently a problem, but I know that in pursuit of this imagined perfection or ideal, I have lost a lot of living. And I say this wondering how much this imagined perfection or ideal has to do with my culture and background, with the larger culture that we all swim in. I think it probably has something to do with cultural whiteness, personally. I think that might be part of the problem. And yet, here we are, so many of us swimming in this water, chasing the idea that if we could just get this aspect of our life under control, all good things would follow. And until that day, goes the lie, I have only myself to blame for the gap between the morning I'm imagining and the morning that takes place. Well, the singer and poet Joss Stone takes a different approach. She tells us, "Got a right to be wrong. My mistakes will make me strong. I'm stepping out into the great unknown, feeling wings though I've never flown." And so this morning, I want to talk with you about that soulful kind of wrong, the kind of wrongs that do make us strong. The wrongs that can lead us ever more boldly into the unknown. The wrongs that remind us of what another poet called las alas perdidas, our forgotten wings. The first kind of wrong I want to talk about is the wrong that is not really wrong, not in a moral sense, not in a legal sense. Not really wrong in the sense of being incorrect, but wrong as in non-conforming. Outside the norm, beyond what is expected. For example, in the history of our own free faith, the Unitarian side of our family tree, in the 1600s in England, congregations that rejected the governance and other aspects of the Church of England were later labeled the non-conforming churches. This stance restricted those congregations from many aspects of social and public life. They lost a lot of status and power because of their theological convictions. They were definitely on the wrong side of the Church of England at that time, but they followed this path into a different way, a different truth, a different life that in some forms we have inherited as Unitarian Universalists today. In a less historical or political example of non-conforming wrongs, I remember when we first handed my son an ice cream cone. He was probably 2 or 3 at the time, and within a moment or two, he had a plan, and he was going to take a huge bite out of this ice cream cone, and he decided to take that bite from the side of the cone. And we laughed and laughed because this is not the right way to eat an ice cream cone. As he was about to discover, it really logistically is very unsound. A lot of melted ice cream was about to come all over him and all over the ice cream cone. And yet, he had broken through our expectations in such a delightful way. I had never considered eating an ice cream cone from the side. What else might he come up with that would shake me out of what I imagined was the best way or the only way or the right way to do things, even common things? I wonder if it is this kind of wrong, the non-conforming wrong, the wrong that disrupts what is expected and normal with a little shock or maybe even delight as it proves that something else is possible. I wonder if it is this kind of wrong that the scholar and cultural critic Judith Halberstam is writing about when she considers the queer art of failure, an exploration of queer identity and countercultural narratives of failure. In her studies, Halberstam rejects the idea of queerness as failed, mistaken, or unsuccessful masculinity or femininity. Instead, she explores how narratives of queer identity and narratives of failure both create powerful alternatives to the dominant narratives of mainstream culture. It is the nonconformity at the heart of what she calls the queer art of failure that allows all of us to imagine different, more expansive, and more liberating ways of doing and being. We imagine the way, the truth, and the life that is beyond the current church. We consider eating our ice cream from the side, no matter the consequences. Halberstam writes, "The queer art of failure turns on the impossible, the improbable, the unlikely, and the unremarkable. It quietly loses," she writes, "and in losing, it imagines other goals for life, for love, for art, and for being." What I find so provocative and world-expanding about Halberstam's arguments is that this is not the familiar narrative of valuing failure as a landmark on the way to eventual success. Right? People who say you have to fail, but it's always wildly successful people who are telling you that failure is so important. My favorite is J.K. Rowling, who gave a very famous address on failure. Now, she really does have more money than the Queen of England. I understand she was not always at that pinnacle of success, but still. In any case, failure in this teaching is held up as its own tool, for its own path, for imagining a different way of living. The second kind of wrong I want to talk about today are the wrongs that cannot be avoided, prepared for, or planned away. These are incorrect or inaccurate wrongs. They come about because of what scientists call human error. Trying to avoid them is akin to saying one will no longer be human anymore. This is the category into which I suggest we put any memorable arguments that you have ever had on facts that can actually be proven, and about which it is in fact proven later that you were wrong. This is often a spouse or family or sibling category of wrong, at least in my history. going south on the highway when your spouse knew it was north and they were right, declaring solemnly that a company sells underwear and not shoes, it sells shoes, or in the case of Catherine Schultz, a journalist who explores error in a book called Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error, relating a case in which she argued at great length that Orion is not a winter constellation. It is, in fact, a winter constellation. So how can we absorb these instances of taking the wrong side in minor and often meaningless arguments and winding up with the intellectual equivalent of a parking citation? A proven instance in which not only were you wrong, you were caught in the wrong. Well, Schultz takes pains to describe exactly what it is in us that leads us into especially these kinds of errors. Namely, our brain is set up to make general conclusions from tiny amounts of data. To know what we know about the world, we can almost never build from foundational truths into more provable truths. This would be deductive reasoning. Instead, we must build from one or two instances a whole universe of conclusions, many of which will be false, but many of which will be true. Our mistakes, Schultz writes, are part and parcel of our brilliance, not the regrettable consequences of a separate and deplorable process. Our options in life are not careful, logical reasoning, through which we get things right, versus shoddy, inductive reasoning, through which we get things wrong. Our options, she says, are inductive reasoning, which probably gets things right, and inductive reasoning, which, because it probably gets things right, sometimes gets things wrong. Believing something on the basis of messy, sparse, limited information really is how we err, she writes, but it is also how we think. What makes us right is what makes us wrong. In other words, being wrong sometimes is the price we pay for being right other times, and it cannot be avoided. Instead of considering my mistakes to be grounds for dismissal from the human family, or maybe just my family, I can try to consider them ever-present reminders of my kinship with the human family, with so many other error-prone people. As I explain to my son that I make 6 mistakes a day, I can explain it to myself as well and hold out my human passport to be stamped with these examples, like a visa, giving me re-entry into the country of all people. Maybe someday I'll get so comfortable with my ordinary human wrongness that I'll apply for legal permanent residency, or perhaps a path to citizenship, rather than thinking of myself as someone who doesn't really belong here and should never have left the island kingdom. Let's call it Harvard University, where we were always right and often harsh in judgment on ourselves and often lonely. Here I am trying this on, a path into an unknown realm of shared vulnerability and weakness and humanity, I might say. This is what it feels like. Oh. Sometimes the Lord comes to us disguised as embarrassment. The poet and priest James Carroll once wrote in his Catholic Christian idiom, before he left the priesthood to become a writer, a husband, and a father of 2 children. My mistakes will make me strong, Stone sings. And I wonder if she means that the strength she finds is the strength of numbers, our common humanity revealed, even in these unwelcome or uncomfortable ways. Might we consider moving from shame to shrug in the margin of such errors? The third kind of wrong I want to talk about this morning grows from this, and you can hear it in the words of the narrator of Wendell Berry's poem, who passed by a young forest growing where he once tried to farm. The farm failed, he tells us, and now the forest is coming back. The poet writes, and I think of all the effort I have wasted, and all the time, and of how much joy I took in that failed work and how much it taught me. How much it taught me. Now, if you are raising children right now, you might have encountered a new educational binary of the fixed mindset and the growth mindset. Is anyone familiar with that? A couple of folks? Yeah, I thought it was you guys that would know about this. The core idea behind this is that some of us were taught that intelligence is something that can't be learned. You're either a smart kid or a dumb kid, a bluebird reader or a soaring eagle. But new studies are showing that this either-or approach to intelligence does not lead to the generally positive outcomes we once thought it did. The new research shows that kids who are labeled gifted and talented often eventually stop accepting new challenges because they can't bear to make mistakes. Or they get anxious because they think that making a mistake means that they aren't smart anymore. The normal or slow kids are hurt too, as lowered expectations for them lead to lowered outcomes in this zone of a fixed mindset. In contrast, when kids are taught a growth mindset, based on the idea that our fantastic, elastic brains keep growing our whole lives, and that mistakes are one of the many ways we know we are growing, those kids are more likely to be resilient in the face of life's inevitable setbacks. They are more likely to take risks in their learning and growing. The question is, how much can we grow? How much might your failed work teach you? The poet continues, "For in so failing, I learned something of my place, something of myself, and now I welcome back the trees." You know, the religious historian Charles Howe once called Universalism the larger faith. And in our seventh principle, we name our place in the interdependent web of all existence, of which we are a part. And in both of these expressions and phrases, it is established again that we are not the whole story, that our lives take place in a vast, interconnected universe of other lives and other stories. On such a great canvas as well, I wonder if our personal wrongs might fade away into the background. I wonder if we could consider in their place how the values I have been speaking of today, of non-conforming alternative ways of doing and being, of reclaiming our kinship and solidarity with the great human family, how they might give us new tools with which to respond courageously to the great wrongs of our culture and our society. Often the news follows me more than I follow the news, and I see before me the husband at the grave of his wife and twin children who were killed in a gas attack in Syria, and he says, weeping, "My children, they were beautiful." And my heart cries out, for they were our children, too. And I hear the story of a mother who is undocumented, whose case will be heard before a judge in immigration court, whose children are citizens who will remain in this country if she is deported. I read the names of the attorneys and the religious leaders of many faiths and the community organizers who are advocating tirelessly for her release. They're writing to the judge, "It is incumbent upon us to stand on the side of the downtrodden, those afflicted by poverty and the sojourner. We pray that you will consider all the evidence before you, and having done so, make a decision that is guided by the spirit of justice." Later, I hear in a crowded hallway, "She's coming home. She's getting out today. The ICE director himself got the bond processed. She will be with her family tonight." And I wonder at the bonds that truly tie each to all. I listen in these tumultuous times to the voices of the young leaders at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, a school that was named for a journalist who fought for voting rights for women, who saved the Everglades, which she called the River of Grass. In an early success of the movement for environmental justice, I listen to their voices refusing to conform to what we all used to know, that gun violence is just the way it is. They say, "We call BS." They say, "Never again." They say, "The way it is now is not the way it should be." Now, they may fail in this new campaign in the long struggle for words over bullets, for peace over violence, but already they have given so many a sweet taste of hope in the bitterness of despair. When I see, when I hear, when I taste this hope, I know it would be a big mistake to get stuck in my own life and in consideration of my own wrongs, and not to follow that path back always into community. And so today, this is my prayer. May some wrongs lead me to laughter and to a shrug rather than shame. May some wrongs help me imagine other goals for life, for love, for art, and for being. May some wrongs bring me further on a path to citizenship in the country of humanity. May some wrongs turn my fixed mind toward a growth mind. May they turn me again and again toward that which is always living and rising and changing, to that which I call God. And may I find my way home not once, but many times, back again to the larger faith, to the field where new young trees are growing, where all are held by the love that will not let us go. May it be so.